This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
We just need a strategy, okay?
Okay, here's the plan.
Two major Supreme Court decisions come down the other day. We break down both of them on Tactics. Welcome to Tactics, right here on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. That's right, you are in the Situation Room right now. Pleasure to be with you this morning. Although I do have to give you a fair warning, little program update here. Our time today is short because the Braves are going to be preempting us right here on News Radio 1440 because we are your home for the Atlanta Braves baseball. That is coming up, another day game. Really excited about that, to be able to bring you that. A little something to listen to at work. Listen to a little relaxing baseball. Always fun to do, and I'll probably have 1440 on in the background while I'm doing some of my podcast editing today because I love day games. I've always loved day games. I mean, I love any baseball, but for whatever reason, there's just some sort of sense of nostalgia doing a day game. Maybe it's because my first several Braves games were day games. I'm not sure exactly why, but I don't know why. I've just always preferred day games. And so we will be bringing one of those to you in just a few minutes here at 9:55 a.m., so we have a little less than an hour. But that does not mean that we are going to take it easy or not bring you the news of the day just because we've got a short day. There is a lot to squeeze into this little bitty hour that we have, and one of those is one of the two major Supreme Court decisions that came down yesterday. I would be remiss if I did not mention them and give you a little bit of a breakdown there. So the NIFLA, I think is the way to say it, the NIFLA versus Becerra. And that was the case that came down yesterday. It was a 5-4 decision in favor of the parent crisis clinics, and Justice Thomas wrote the opinion. So to get your head wrapped around exactly what was going on in this particular case, you might remember that our good friend of the program, Attorney Matt Clark, came on and broke this down with us from the Foundation for Moral Law. Essentially what this case did is there are parent crisis centers all over the state of California, and several Christian groups, several pro-life groups, because, of course, abortion is something that is so prominent in our society today, and because it's something that many of us, like myself, abhor, they offered some solutions, they offered some alternatives to what was going on in California. They were opening these clinics just essentially to inform women that there are other options besides abortion. You can have the child and adopt. They gave them advice on motherhood and how to manage their pregnancy and talked about advice for contraception, all of these things. Essentially the same thing that a lot of the other clinics are doing, with the exception of offering Plan B pills or abortion as a alternative. And so that was the only main difference. And they did that specifically so there would be clinics that offered all those services without having or encouraging women to get abortions, which, by the way, we could go back into the history of that. Planned Parenthood has been shown to be encouraging abortions because they make so much money off of it. And so you could go back into all that. But anyway, that was the purpose of these clinics. And these clinics started popping up all over the state of California. California, being a very pro-abortion state, did not like that. And so they tried to come up with a law that would make them not able to do so. And so essentially what their law said is that if you are one of these parent counseling clinics and you do not offer abortion, you still have to inform all of your patients that abortion is an option. So you have to have flyers, you have to have posters on the wall, you have to inform the patient that abortion is part of the option that they can have. And of course, this led to a lawsuit saying, you can't tell us what we do and do not have to say. And the way that California justified it is, well, they're professionals and they're doctors, and so doctors must inform their patients of all possible treatments, all possible solutions to the thing that they're seeking help with. Which I said was akin to, because these organizations were built essentially on the idea that we don't like abortion, we don't want to promote it. And so that made them even having a clinic completely pointless, because they were trying to stop abortion. Whether you agree or with abortion or not, they saw it as something evil and something that was bad, and that because of that, they were trying to stop it from happening. So it was essentially like, imagine this, it would be like at an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting that by law is forced to put up ads for the local bar. It doesn't make any sense. It's something that they view as a moral evil. And because of that, the state of California says, no, 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 we like abortion, therefore you have to promote it. You have to actively give your patients information on state-funded abortions, ways to pay for it without them having to pay for it out of pocket. So there were all these regulations on it, and the decision came down yesterday with Justice Thomas writing the opinion 5-4, saying that no, the state of California cannot compel people to essentially to violate their beliefs in doing so. And really, this whole law was just a way to prevent these centers that don't promote abortions. They were trying to find a tricky way around just being able to shut them down outright. So instead of shutting them down, they said, oh, you can essentially have these clinics, but if you do, you're going to have to inform patients the way we would inform patients. It's conditional freedom. It's the same thing that we have in the public school system. Especially in a lot of blue states. Well, you can homeschool, or you can have a private school, but you have to teach everything exactly the way that we would teach it. Well, then that's not freedom, and that defeats the point of having it, which is essentially what they're trying to do anyway. They're trying to say, we think this thing shouldn't exist, but we can't ban it outright, so we'll find a way to make it to where, even though we can't ban it, it's exactly like the version that we would do. And so it is a gross abridgment of freedom. And I gotta say, it is kind of a weird stance to say you must not help pregnant women without promoting abortions. We can't have people just out there helping pregnant women and giving them advice unless that advice includes abortions, which is the way that we would do it. It's just a really strange thing to bring up. Even if you're pro-choice, I think that that's weird that you say you cannot help women at all. You cannot have one of these facilities unless abortion is included in your platform. And so the argument that they made on the side of California, they said that you should be able to mandate and that you prescribe these methods because you are a professional. So because you're a professional, because you're a doctor or a nurse or whatever, you are required by law because of your profession to promote certain practices under the law, which I found really strange, because aren't bakers professionals? Aren't florists professionals? And so on the one hand, you have in the, for example, the Masterpiece Cake Shop decision, you have a baker or a florist that it may be a Christian or have religious objections to doing something for a gay wedding. And the liberals will say, and you remember we listened to this clip the other day, the segment where they went and interviewed a whole bunch of people on George Washington University's campus. And they said, well, yeah, of course they should have to bake the cake. That's their job. They're professionals. They can't just deny service to people. But then those same people are now saying, well, you know, they're a professional, so they have to prescribe it this way. It is funny. Are not bakers and florists professionals as well? And so, and isn't their art speech? And so really, it's the same thing. They're trying to compel somebody's speech because they are a professional. And so it is, I mean, it just goes to show that the left is all about control. So here we go. I'll read a segment from this opinion. Here, for example, licensed clinics must provide a government-drafted script about the availability of state-sponsored services, as well as contact information for how to obtain them. One of those services is abortion, the very practice that the petitioners are devoted to opposing. By requiring petitioners to inform women how they can obtain state-subsidized abortions, at the same time petitioners try to dissuade women from choosing that option, the license notice plainly, quote, alters the content of the petitioner's speech. And so that came directly from Justice Thomas's opinion, and that was exactly the argument that I came out with when this case went to the Supreme Court, which is, it defeats the purpose of having a clinic. you are, the whole purpose of you putting that clinic together is so women would have an option where the abortion is not promoted. And they are saying, no, 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 you have to promote this. In other words, just because you are a professional, we have to change. We have to alter the content of your speech and what you're saying because we don't like the way that you're speaking right now. But you have to keep in mind, silence is also part of free speech. Part of free speech also means, and I mean, they could bash abortion, I guess. They could tell them that abortion is a bad idea, which would also be free speech. But part of free speech is also saying nothing. The right to say nothing is also a part of that amendment and that idea of free speech. So they keep going on in this particular opinion. Although the license notice is content-based, the Ninth Circuit did not apply strict scrutiny because it concluded that the notice regulates, quote, professional speech. But this court has not recognized professional speech as a separate category of speech. Speech is not unprotected merely because it is uttered by professionals. The court has been, quote, reluctant to mark off any new categories of speech for diminished constitutional protection, end quote. So in other words, what this opinion is saying is, yeah, professional speech, that's not a thing. The Supreme Court has never recognized professional speech. And so you can't just say, well, it's professional speech, therefore we can regulate it. No, no, no. There's no such thing as professional speech. There is free speech and there is not free speech, and this is clearly a violation of free speech. Same thing with hate speech. They recognize that in a case last year, essentially saying, yeah, hate speech is not a thing. And that was in a 9-0 decision. But when it came to professional speech, that's essentially what they're saying, is that the court can recognize it if they want to, but there's not a certain subcategory of speech that has less constitutional protection just because the person happens to be a licensed professional. Being a professional does not mean you turn over your rights at the door. It's not like you become a doctor and say, you know what, I'm not allowed to say certain things. I understand that, so I can't say these certain things when I'm going into this profession. That's not a thing. And that is essentially what the Supreme Court reasoned the other day in this opinion. That also further strengthens it by saying that this is the fact that it's controversial doesn't matter. So if you look later in the opinion, this is one thing that they address. They say, yeah, abortion is a contentious issue, and what they're saying may or may not be viewed as controversial, but that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter if it's insanely controversial, or if it's not controversial at all, then they still can't regulate their speech. For example, if there were an opinion that a doctor had that is completely not in keeping with modern medicine, that doesn't mean that their right of speech goes away. Even if there is a wide community of agreement between most professionals, you still can't regulate that speech. Now, maybe a licensing board or something like that could revoke their license if they were doing that, but they certainly cannot bring a legal challenge to them based on what they want to say. Being a professional does not mean that your free speech goes out the window just because you have a license and you practice medicine or any other profession. I wish that they had taken that stance in Masterpiece Cake Shop, because they would have defended it on much broader ground and given a much more significant standing had they taken that wide view of it and flat out said that this is a free speech violation. I mean, I'm glad that we won the Masterpiece Cake Shop case, but I was quite surprised that, not surprised, but I was disappointed that they did not have a stronger stance on it or be more clear on it. It was slightly vague. So the bottom line in all of this is a big win for free speech. This is a big win for the First Amendment, in particular when it comes to speech, for example, regarding pro-life. So if you're anti-abortion, you do not have to prescribe that. You cannot be compelled by a state government to prescribe a practice that you believe is incorrect or immoral. And you also are not barred from doing so if you want to. So big win for the First Amendment, big win for the pro-life movement. And there's another case that's coming up in just a second. It is Trump's travel ban. We're going to get to that and get to all the details in just a minute.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
The Christian religion is, above all the religions that ever prevailed or existed in ancient or modern times, the religion of wisdom, virtue, equity, and humanity. John Adams.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and newsradio1440.com. 860-1440, that is the number if you want to get in touch with me. And we're talking about the Supreme Court, but real quick before we get to that second decision by the Supreme Court yesterday on the travel ban, I wanted to bring this up because my buddy Chris actually wrote me during the commercial break and he was asking me a question. He says, I don't understand how exactly it is that people are making this comparison between Japanese internment and the migrant crisis. It doesn't make any sense. And I told him that the answer was actually pretty simple. The reason he wasn't understanding it, it's because you, A, think logically, and B, have a basic understanding of history. The people that are making that comparison are lacking in either one area, and most of the time, both. And that's really the issue that you're running into. If you are not a logical thinker or you do not know history very well, then you can see how somebody would arrive to that conclusion. Pretty much those two things completely alleviate any comparisons to be made. However, we do have something else going on with the Trump administration, Trump versus Hawaii, which the decision for this happened just the other day. There was a 5-4 decision in favor of the president. Justice Roberts writes the opinion. This is the fourth version of the travel ban, because you'll remember there were multiple drafts of this thing written. A whole bunch of federal judges kept striking it down, saying that the president doesn't have the authority to do this, saying that this was a Muslim ban and that it specifically targeted a religious group. So the argument of the people representing Hawaii, the state of Hawaii, because that's where this challenge came from, out of one of their courts, basically boils down to Trump is mean to Muslims. And that was what they said. They did call it and I mean, to their credit, and I'm not making the case that they were in the right by saying that it should be unconstitutional because of this. I'm just saying that the evidence that they posed there was solid evidence, which is he did call it a Muslim ban on multiple occasions. His tweets also, you could argue, showed animus towards Muslims. Some of the way that it's worded, I mean, let's be honest, Donald Trump is not exactly precise or careful in his wording of anything, and that's why even if that's not necessarily what he means, he can come off with the wrong message. Whether he meant it or not, I don't know. But the point is, there are some tweets that were problematic when it came to this. And the argument of the side for the president was, it was a ban on nations, which is not a ban on religion. What it specifically justified is high-risk nations that did not have identification processes that we could go and back-check. So, for example, when you're going into some of these countries that just do not have record-keeping the way that America does, I know that's hard for us to think about since everything's online and you can basically see somebody's life story just by looking at their Facebook page. The reason that this was different over there is because you would run a background check, for example, on Ahmed. We'll just use some random name, and it pops up, oh, he doesn't have a criminal record, there's no record of terrorism here, okay, you're good, you can go right into the United States. Well, the reason that that's a problem is because back there, the record keeping isn't really a thing. And so, yes, you're not seeing any problems, you're not seeing any violations, but that's because there are no records, period. This guy could be an actual ISIS terrorist, a known ISIS terrorist, or, I mean, that was the issue right then, or, you know, whatever else it may be, or even just a petty criminal, and it's not going to show up because their record keeping is not what America's record keeping is. So, because of that, that was really the justification of the president for passing this. And the argument on the pro-president side for why this is not actually a Muslim ban is that 83% of Muslim nations were not banned, which is true. If you're looking at the majority Muslim nations across the country, 83% of them were not banned. It was just these few countries. I don't know exactly how many because there were so many different iterations of the travel ban, and they included different countries at different times and different numbers. But 83% of those Muslim nations were not banned, and other high-risk areas such as Venezuela and North Korea were also included despite not having a large Muslim population. And so basically their argument was, well, if the president was trying to make a Muslim ban, he did a really terrible job of it because there's lots of Muslim countries that are still allowed to travel that isn't covered by this ban, and there's two countries that are included in the ban that aren't Muslim at all. And so it does break down that argument that they were making that this is specifically a ban against Muslims and that it was the federal government favoring one religion over another. Now, that being said, one of the things that they mentioned in the opinion was that Congress has essentially delegated this authority to the president, which is a really stupid idea. The Supreme Court doesn't say this. This is my commentary. But part of the reason that you're seeing this and part of the reason you're having this outrage is because Congress has been, for decades, delegating away its own authority to the president and to the executive branch. And the thing is, they should have never given up that authority, and then it wouldn't be a big deal. Then the president wouldn't have even had the ability to do this. And it would have been the purview of Congress, and if we wanted to put forward a travel ban, which wasn't a bad idea, I don't disagree with the policy itself, I just disagree with the way that it was implemented. Congress should have retained their power, and if Democrats had not been so gung-ho about ruling by the executive branch the way that they did under Barack Obama and just ignoring the role of Congress and the separation of powers, then Trump wouldn't have been able to do this in the first place. So, that being said, and that power creep where the executive branch is getting larger, that was not just Barack Obama. That's been happening for decades, and it's not just Democrats. But my point is, if you are so terrified of one person having that much power, then maybe you should be more for the separation of powers and of Congress actually doing its job. But that being said, essentially their reasoning for their decision was the actual text of the law does not contain any anti-Muslim language. So the tweets and the speeches that President Trump gave where he called it a Muslim ban, those are essentially a non-starter. They shouldn't be considered as to whether or not this actually was a Muslim ban or not, because the actual raw wording of the law does not suggest that it's a Muslim ban, which I think is the right call, because let's just say, for example, that Trump actually was a racist that hates Muslims and wants to keep them out. What would that mean? That as president, he would then be barred from any legitimate action that he could take to protect the country. Because I'm not saying that it's a good thing. I'm not saying that, goodness knows, I'm as frustrated with Trump's tweets and how he runs his mouth as everybody else. I think that it would be much more beneficial to his cause and his agenda if he would just quit Twitter altogether. But my point in all of this is, let's just say that Trump was an avid racist, somebody that everybody knew that he hated Muslims. Let's just say that for the sake of argument. Would that then mean that his legal authority to protect us from any nation that happened to be majority Muslims would then be null and void just because of his stance? Now, if he writes a law that specifically targets Muslims, that's bad. That's not a good thing. And that should be ruled unconstitutional. But I'm just saying, in that scenario, if we did have a president that was legitimately racist, would he then not be able to do his job and protect the country just because he has that bias, and he would then be incapable of doing even common sense things that do not, in the letter of the law or in the execution of the law, actually denigrate or belittle people? So that's the issue that you're having there, that if the actual text of the law doesn't contain any anti-Muslim language and it does not seem to specifically target Muslims, then you can't say that the law in and of itself is unconstitutional. That's what the Supreme Court found in a 5-4 decision. And I wish that this standard, honestly, I wish that this standard had been applied to Obamacare, where you look at the actual text of the law as opposed to just a vague platitude or vague platitude is not the right word to say. I prefer Justice Scalia's wording, but that's actually a different case. So I wish that this same scrutiny had been applied to Obamacare, which is, well, let's look at the actual text of the law, not what they meant to say, not what we think they might have said, not some of the speech surrounding it, even though the speech surrounding it was saying that it was a fee and not a tax. So, again, you run into a problem there. But just look at the actual text of the law and judge based on what it says, not find a way to make it justified in your own mind. And I wish that they had applied that same logic, which is ironic because it's Justice, because it is Justice Roberts issuing this opinion. And they also said one thing, too, that lower courts need to be very cautious in national security matters. Which, I mean, makes sense. That if it's a national security, then judges, you ought not challenge that and put a hold on it unless you are darn sure that there's a problem. And that was one of the cautionary warnings, I guess you could say, that the Supreme Court issued to lower courts on this particular matter. So there have been some good and bad in most of the Supreme Court decisions that have come down, even the ones that went our way. You know, there are certain things here or there that may have been better. With this one, I don't think that you could have gotten an any bigger win. This is a huge win for the president because the court not only said that, yes, Donald Trump was well within his authority to do, though, and yes, Donald Trump's executive order is perfectly constitutional. They also said, by the way, courts, you need to knock off this judicial activism where just because you don't like the guy and you don't really have any legal standing to do so, or you don't like the content of the executive order itself, you say that it's unconstitutional. If you say it's unconstitutional, it better be unconstitutional. And so that was a warning that the Supreme Court gave to judges of the lower courts. They said, especially in matters of urgency when it comes to national security. So this is a really huge win for the President of the United States. We'll talk a little bit more about this in some of the dissent from Sonia Sotomayor in just a second. We'll be right back.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.
Galatians 5:1. It was for freedom that Christ set us free. Therefore, keep standing firm and do not be subject again to a yoke of slavery.
Welcome back. You're listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com, 860-1440. That's the number if you want to get in touch with us. On the Supreme Court case, there was an interesting idea, and by interesting I mean stupid, that came out the other day in an article by CNN, which I'm sure comes as no surprise to anybody. So the headline from CNN was, is the Supreme Court biased when it comes to religion? And this is partly going on the heels of the dissent by Justice Sonia Sotomayor. And she said that there is a double standard when it comes to Muslims versus Christians. Right. I mean, because we all know that if anything, the problem with the government is that it's overly pro-Christian, right? That's the big issue that we have with the government, is that it's known for being notoriously pro-Christian. I mean, anybody that's been paying attention knows right off the bat that that is utterly ridiculous. But let's actually get into the subject matter, the meat of what she's talking about. In Sotomayor's dissent, she wrote, unlike in Masterpiece, you remember the case with the baker who the gay couple wanted to make a wedding cake for them. She says, unlike in Masterpiece, where the majority considered the same commissioner's the state commissioner's statement about religion to be persuasive evidence for unconstitutional government action, the majority here completely sets aside the president's charge statements about Muslims as irrelevant. There's a good reason for that. When it comes to the Masterpiece case, for example, the opinion states that the issue was how the policy was enforced, not the policy itself. That's the big difference. That's the issue that you're running into, and the reason that it seems one-sided from your perspective. You're not considering that that had to do with enforcement. So in that case, they didn't rule that the law itself was discriminatory. They said that the way that the law was applied was discriminatory towards Christians. In this case, they're saying both the raw text and the enforcement are perfectly fine. You cannot base your legal decisions on quotes by people that were enacting the law completely separate from how the law is written and how the law was enforced. The difference is, when you're going back to Masterpiece, that dealt with the way that it was enforced and the method by which they used to enforce it. They were enforcing the law strictly upon him, and doing so specifically because, at least according to the Supreme Court's decision, or their opinion, there was a notable animus against the bakery owner in that particular case. In other words, there was very strong evidence to show anti-Christian sentiment in that case. Although, what I do find funny about this is that Sonia Sotomayor is pointing that out, and she was in the minority. She was in the dissenting two justices in the Masterpiece Cake Shop Theater. And so if you're holding Sonia Sotomayor to her own reasoning, then that means that if this is the issue and that you can use these incidental, if she's saying it's the same, I don't think it's the same, but if she's saying it's the same thing, why then did she not side with the majority when it came to Masterpiece Cake Shop? Because she's an activist liberal shill. That's why. And so she makes this argument, ironically, not realizing that it shows her to be somebody that just sides with her team, not the law. If you really believe that, if you really believed that there was bias when it came to that, then why were you on the opposite side in this case? Now, the case of the court is completely consistent here, because one side dealt with specifically enforcing the law and the way that the law was put forward. It, not the law itself, but the way that the law was enforced. This case, neither enforcement nor the raw text of the law has anything to do with Muslims. It was speech surrounding it and based on the person who actually wrote the law saying things that were anti-Muslim or at least could be perceived as anti-Muslim that they were trying to use in the argument. They're saying, no, we don't deal with that. We deal with the law and the way that the law is enforced. And in Masterpiece Cake Shop, they said the law was enforced incorrectly here because there was anti-Christian sentiment. But Sonia Sotomayor is saying, well, there was anti-Muslim sentiment in here, and so it should be the same thing. Well, maybe there was surrounding the law, but not in the law itself, nor in the law's enforcement. And if that's the case, if she really believes that, why then did she take the other side when it came to Masterpiece Cake Shop? It really doesn't make any sense. And so Sonia Sotomayor kind of shoots herself in the foot rhetorically when it comes to this in her own dissent. So we got the Chaplain's Report up next, and then we're going to take you off to some Braves baseball. That's coming up in just a second.
This is a News Radio 1440 podcast.
Philippians 1:21. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain.
Welcome back. You are listening to Tactics on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com. 860-1440, that's the way to get in touch with me if you have a strong, abiding desire to do so. But right now we have the Chaplain's Report. We've got to end it a little bit early today because the Braves are going to have a day game. Very excited about that. We'll be bringing that to you just in a couple minutes, and we're going to go to that as soon as the Chaplain's Report is over. But with the Chaplain's Report, I did want to go ahead and go to this. 2 Corinthians 5, verses 1 through 4. For we know that if the earthly tent, which is our house, is torn down, we have a building from God, a house not made with hands, eternal in the heavens. For indeed, in this house we groan, longing to be clothed for our dwelling from heaven, insomuch as we, having put it on, will not be found naked. For indeed, while we are in this tent, we groan, being burdened, because we do not want to be unclothed, but to be clothed, so that what is mortal will be swallowed up by life. There's a couple things that I want you to notice about this. First of all, the big problem here, the conundrum that Paul is saying, is we don't feel at home. We don't feel at home in our own bodies. We don't feel at home in this world. As a Christian, we're supposed to feel like pilgrims, sojourners, people who do not belong to this earth, because we don't belong to this earth. We belong to God. We no longer live as a part of this world. We live as a part of God's family that happens to be in this world at this time. And I love the analogy he gives here, especially considering that Paul himself made tents. That was his profession. That we should think of this current body, this current world, as a tent. It's temporary. It's mobile. It's something that you can grab up and take away with you quickly, but once we go home, we're going to go to a home that was not made with hands, a home that was not built by mortals, a home that doesn't go away, a home that doesn't have to be moved, a home that lasts, that is safe, that comforts us. And I love this symbolism that he uses here about it being naked. He's saying essentially that, that is going to be go away, that is going to be cast away, and we will be clothed with the righteousness of God. That is really the ultimate goal when it comes to us, is that we'll be clothed by God in his righteousness and we'll go to live with him eternally. Stay the course, friends.
Tactics with Caleb Colquitt, every weekday from 9 to 11, only on News Radio 1440 and NewsRadio1440.com.